There is a kind of sense of ritual often in live performance, which is very important to me, this sense that this is no longer our everyday life. This is something else that we are all agreeing to step into together, even though it's in the same room we were just in, right? It's really that something begins and suddenly something about that space is transformed, so it doesn't feel the same. It feels like a different phase of life or a different journey. You might be sitting still, but you will have this sense of traveling.
Welcome to CC, the podcast where you see what others see.
Hi there. Good morning. So today, what are we talking about? Hello? Hello? Can you hear me? Ceci here. Is anyone there? Hi, my name is Ceci. I'm based in Berlin, and I want to welcome you to CC, the podcast where you see what others see.
This season is all about the mind. And today we'll be diving into the magical world of music. How is it made? The ways we listen to it? How we feel it? And how it ties into improvisation, rhythm, empathy, love, and compassion. And guess with whom we'll be talking.
Our guest today is Vijay Iyer, a composer, pianist, band leader, and scholar described by the New York Times as a social conscience, multimedia collaborator, system builder, rhapsodist, historical thinker, and multicultural gateway, an influential, prolific, shape-shifting presence in 21st century music. Vijay Iyer has spent more than three decades building a body of work that's both innovative and emotionally resonant. This has earned him three Grammy nominations and other honors, including the MacArthur Fellowship, the Alpert Award in the Arts, the Doris Duke Performing Artist Award, the Greenfield Prize, a Dutch Edison Prize, and two German Echo Awards. He was also voted Downbeat Magazine's Jazz Artist of the Year four times and has been praised by Pitchfork as one of the best in the world at what he does, by the Los Angeles Weekly as a boundless and deeply important young star, and by Minnesota Public Radio as an American treasure. He's the Franklin D. and Florence Rosenblatt Professor of the Arts at Harvard University, with joint appointments in the departments of music and of African and African American studies, where he also founded the doctoral program in creative practice and critical inquiry. Iyer's most recent albums highlight the range of his artistry. Defiant Life, his second suite of duets with visionary composer trumpeter Wadada Leo Smith, comprising hypnotic, acoustic, and electronic soundscapes. The widely acclaimed Compassion, featuring his dynamic trio with Tyshawn Sorry and Linda Mahan Oh. Trouble, a portrait of his orchestral works, including the Violin Concerto, performed by virtuosi Jennifer Coe and the Boston Modern Orchestra Project. His Grammy-nominated collaboration with Aruj Aftab and Shahzad Ismaili, Love in Exile, and most recently, Thereupon, the long-awaited return of Fieldwork, an all-star collective comprising Iyer, saxophonist Steve Lehman, and drummer Tyshawn Sorry. Iyer is also a prolific classical composer, with works premiered by the London Philharmonic, the Oregon Symphony, American Composers Orchestra, Orpheus Chamber Orchestra, East Coast Chamber Orchestra, and LA Philharmonic, among many others. As the New York Times has written, his music is intelligent and unpretentious, complex without being opaque, unveiling layers of subtle emotion before letting it fly with joyous abandon. Vijay Iyer is, in every sense, a transformative figure, reshaping how we think about rhythm, improvisation, and listening itself.
Mr. Iyer, what a joy to have you at our studio in Berlin with us today. Welcome.
Thanks so much. I'm glad it worked out. Glad to be here.
Your music carries a deep sense of discovery and mindfulness. There's never any rush. You take your time, whether moving slowly or picking up the pace. You feel, you play, you improvise. And through that, you create an experience that feels familiar. You know how to bind humans with music. And you've described music, and I quote you, as something that happens to your body. And I'd like to ask about the embodied dimension of music making.
Thank you, first of all, for all those flattering words. I think it's worth reminding ourselves that we are embodied first. You know, it's not something that gets added later. And so it's the beginning of everything. It's the beginning of everything we ever do, ever experience, including thought. And when I say we are embodied, all it means is that we not only possess bodies, but our bodies are ourselves. We are our bodies. And also that we are bodies among bodies from the beginning, from before birth, even when we hear our mother's heartbeat, before we hear or experience anything else, before we even know that we are hearing anything. So this sense of not just individual but mutual embodiment is the beginning of everything that we ever do, ever know, ever feel. And so that is just how music begins. When I say how music begins, I mean in any given musical experience, that's how it begins. But also probably on the time scale of humankind, that's how music begins, by us listening to ourselves and each other, doing things, moving and making sound through our actions. When I think of my earliest musical experiences, some of my earliest memories, really, one of my earliest memories that I cherish is being with my sister at her piano when I was about 3 or 4. We just banged on it together, made a joyful noise. And what I remember about that is kind of sensory saturation, not just in the realm of listening or in my ears, but kind of in my whole body, in the sense that I remember the entire instrument vibrating and it sort of vibrating me. Particularly using the sustain pedal and then feeling the vibration of the instrument through my feet, you know. So that sensation is something I'm always trying to experience again. It's something I'm always reaching for every time I touch the piano, is to feel it touch me back. And a sort of a mutual vibration that's happening. I mean, if we think of the instrument as also a body, you know, that is also vibrating. It responds to my actions, and then it produces its own spectrum of movement, you know, of strings vibrating and other strings vibrating sympathetically, and the way the air around it shakes because of that, and the way it bounces off the walls, and the way I feel it, not just in my ears, but through every surface of and I think, but also like the low end of the piano has this kind of depth that sort of reaches me in my gut, and that is a feeling that also I am always going back to.
How would you describe your physical experience when creating music individually as compared to performing within an ensemble? Are there differences in how you experience or inhabit your body in those contexts?
You asked about how it's different making music with other people. I mean, I guess maybe if we think of all of it as a set of relations among bodies and objects, that we're all in this network of action and reaction that we are feeling at every moment.
You mentioning how our cognitive abilities connect with our senses, our body, that we first are body, and how after the sensations comes the thought. Well, that makes me think about when music is made and performed, how there's a space that it's created by musicians and listeners. So in what ways does the rhythm of heartbeats and breathing shape the shared physical experience of music?
Well, it's partly that what music is made of is tapping into those cycles. The cycle of the heartbeat, the cycle of breath, the cycle of walking, the cycles of speech. These are all the ingredients of what music is made of, and that's not by coincidence. It's because it all comes from the same place, which is us. or through us, let's say. Music is always organized according to those cycles because that's how we make it. Literally, when you sing a phrase, then you run out of breath, then you inhale and you start again. That's where it lives. It lives right there. Right. And similarly with pulse, we always, if music has a tempo, it's somewhere in the range of a tempo that you've experienced as a pulse, as like your heartbeat or as walking or something like that, or running. So music goes right there. It starts from those kinds of actions. And that's also how we synchronize. And that's one of the remarkable things that we can do with each other, is that we can synchronize, not just in the realm of pulse, which is how, of course, we play together, for example, but also in the realm of breath. I've had experiences many times, almost all the, routinely, where I, we reach the end of a piece of music and I hear the entire audience exhale together. I'm not saying that I am particularly in possession of some magic any more than anyone else, is okay. What I mean, is that this is just simply a fact about who and what we are, that we can do this for each other, that we can furnish this kind of experience for each other.
Yeah, and these exchanges in breath and in heartbeat, that's exactly what by writing, by painting, and you mentioning now by making music is what artificial intelligence cannot do. Yeah. Well, up next, we will hear a translator of light, rhythm, and human emotion. This is Italian photographer Domingo Milella, describing the experience of entering the caves he photographs as stepping from the outside world into a common mind space.
This young man that looks at the outside world only to find demonstration of his own identity and his own personality, which is the first part of my life, then starts to listen to something else. And this listening come in interesting shapes. The space I entered going into the cave has to do much more with the invisible and the interior. And definitely it's a space where time doesn't exist. What I'm interested in and what I want to try to share is this lack of filter and lack of constructions. I went into caves because I was looking for a connection with the primordial and the essential. So in a certain way, the interior of the mountain is the interior of a treasure and this interior of a memory that doesn't only belong to humans. This memory is the point of encounter of a memory that belongs to the world.
When musicians and listeners are exchanging all this energy, have you experienced, and you mentioned that already with the exhaling of the breath in the audience, but have you ever experienced what Domingo describes as entering a dimension of shared mind space?
I'm trying to think of a time when we're not in that space. It's more that we forget that it's there, you know? I find it fascinating the effort to go to such lengths to touch something primordial. I understand that he, as an artist who works with light and creates representations of the world around us, might have that drive and that impulse to physically go somewhere novel and remote and rarefied to touch that. But I'm certain that we can touch it right now, right here where we are. I know that it's there because music brings me to that place all the time. Not just mine. I mean, I think it's about like accessing these places where, or these moments, or these experiences where form appears from non-form and then recedes in back into this primordial non-form, right?
You're absolutely right. You know, I want us to hear Dr. Paul Bann, a foremost authority on prehistoric art and archaeology, talk about a very special engraving, something meant exactly as you were saying, an experience where form appears from the non-form, the representation, the expression of abstraction.
A cave in France, not very well known, called Pergouzet, which Michel Lorblanchet, who is the greatest scholar we have of cave art, he spent 10 long years suffering, studying this cave, Pergouzet. So the entrance of Pergouzet is now what used to be a hole at the back of that entrance chamber. So you have this little hole at the side of the road. You go into that. You then have 150 meters of crawling flat out, pulling with your fingers and toes through wet mud. And of course, we have lights on our forehead now. The Ice Age people were carrying a lamp. And at the end of the 150 meters, then you can stand up. And then they started decorating the cave, and there are some beautiful engraving. But the extraordinary discovery that Michel made was that in the decorated chamber, there is a little niche in the wall, and he couldn't get his head inside. It's too small, but he thought there was something in there. So he inserted a camera, took a picture. And sure enough, there is an engraving in there of, we think it's a horse head. Now, even that artist never saw that image. It was done by touch. The artist reached into that and engraved it by touch. So it was never, ever meant for anybody else to see. It's the ultimate in private art. And this is the thing, some of the cave art is clearly on view. It's meant for the public or whoever was allowed to see it. But a certain amount of it is so hidden and so secret. It has to be spiritual, it has to be religious in some way, whether it's an offering to a god or a spirit or an ancestor or a thank you. But that is the ultimate, whether even the artist, him or herself, never saw that image.
I think that finding speaks for a beautiful metaphor to this mind space we have been circling. That place we keep coming back to again and again to ground ourselves, to feel we are there, our own sense of self, so to say.
If we really just tap into it, that's happening all around us all the time. And that's, again, the breath is that, you know, it is that. And the fact that we might be able to experience some sort of synchronous action, like a synchronous movement or a synchronous breath, reminds us that we aren't alone. Even these, like, experiences of the threshold of living and dying, like witnessing a birth or grief, grieving a loss, where we are brought to the brink of our own understanding of ourselves, you know, that's all part of the same phenomenon.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. And so we've been talking about the dialogues that happen during the process of making music, those dialogues with yourself, with your fellow musicians, and with the audience too. And this made me think about the many joys that a musical experience can bring. And you know, during a performance, there are moments where the listener is kind of drawn into the performance. Moments where the identities of the listener and the performer blur. And I'm not just talking about live performances. This could also extend to the hearing of music on the radio and LP, ACD, and so on. And a great example of this phenomenon for me would be Prince. That's one of my favorite songs.
Mine
Little
too.
Red Corvette. Great. I was actually, you know, listening to it while I was preparing for this interview, and I just realized when he was performing, it was like he's not just singing, he's inviting the listener to step into his world. And you can feel yourself dancing and moving and being in the middle of that energy. And you know, as I'm reflecting on all of this, my youngest son, he comes in and he says, "I like that song." He's 7. "Play it again." And then he's mimicking it and acting it out and feeling it completely. And I thought that's what great artists and performers do. They create a shared space where music and performer and audience meet. And something really transformative happens, right?
Mm. Yeah, I had the honor of getting to see Prince perform live a few times. I remember the last time was in the late 90s in California. It was an outdoor amphitheater, and I was very far away from him. We were like, I don't know, 20,000 people there, and I was towards the back of the lawn behind the amphitheater. I still felt like he was playing the concert for me. You know, it was really...
Exactly.
He reached me just directly. Of course, I was already a super fan, so probably by then listening to him for almost 20 years. I was thinking of your young son listening to that song and having his own joy in it. But I'm sure he doesn't know what it's about.
No, not at all.
He's a little too young maybe to appreciate the... all. It's nothing but double entendres, the entire... Yeah. There's something in it that's beyond what the lyrics purport to do, right? Or that it has all these levels of experience to it, or all these different... Or maybe another way to put it is that it opens itself to anyone. And this is what music does at its best, is that it allows you to have your own experience with it.
Exactly.
No matter who you are or what you know.
Yeah, because there's also a lot of sexual energy in it. No, but you know, this is not a negative, destructive sexual energy of hierarchy or so. It's a drive. It's a creative energy, actually.
Mm.
So I think that's
Eros.
What, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's what invites everybody into this joyful movement of life, of maybe procreating and creating and this positive energy of feeling alive.
Yeah, for feeling alive and creating life. And, you know, this is, I think it was Susan McClary who said that music and sexuality are not exactly the same, but they live right next door to each other. So maybe, I mean, if we are going to fully accept that music is embodied, then we have to accept that it has something to do with everything else that our bodies do.
With mortality.
Yes, with life, creating life, celebrating life, mourning life, you know, that is all part of what our bodies do. Yeah, and I think like that, the fact that, well, I had the opportunity to interview someone who had been a kind of mentor to me, Muhal Richard Abrams, who's a composer and pianist. He passed away in 2017. I think it was in 2012 that I recorded an interview with him that got published later. He said, you know, you play a concert and you talk to 5 people and they all say something different afterward. Like they all had a different experience. And he says, the purpose of music is to excite all of these different experiences. The purpose, which is really profound. which is to say, it's not meant to be heard in one way. It's meant to open up a world for you that you can then experience on your terms.
And have you managed to transform the venues where you perform into an intellectual and or emotional playground for everyone to explore together?
I don't know about intellectual. I try to leave that behind.
Because your music is sometimes intellectual.
Well, I don't know. I think that just depends on what somebody knows.
Yeah.
My music is in a...
But embodied intellectual.
Well, that's good. Everything I do is in some lineage, you know? So it's not like I am the first person to have some of these thoughts, you know? I think the thing is that music becomes visceral in the context of live experience. And this is another thing that we tend to forget because we are so used to listening to recordings, that music was first a live, shared, visceral, mutually embodied experience. It was always that. If I told you about a musical experience from 1825, 200 years ago, you can be assured that what that was about was somebody hearing somebody, right? So I insist on it being brought back to that place. And I think there is a kind of sense of ritual often in live performance, which is very important to me, this sense that this is no longer our everyday life. This is something else that we are all agreeing to step into together, even though it's in the same room we were just in, right?
Yeah.
It's really that something begins and suddenly something about that space is transformed, so it doesn't feel the same. It feels like a different phase of life or a different journey. You might be sitting still, but you will have this sense of traveling.
How important is the type of audience you perform for in achieving this, in stepping out to another realm, what you were saying?
I mean, I've played all over the planet for all kinds of people. And I am continually assured that music works. It does something that nothing else does. And I place a lot of trust in that fact, but it keeps affirming itself. So I don't know how to talk about a type of audience. It's an interaction, you know? So I make it my business to reach people. And if I'm not, then I change what I'm doing. So that, and I don't mean I am pandering. I change the attitude with which I'm doing it. I guess I'll put it that way.
Well, famous British choreographer Alexander Whitley is internationally praised for his boundary-pushing work that fuses dance, technology, and visual art. Let's listen to him talk about collective exploration and transformative exchanges that can shift individual awareness towards connectivity.
There's always a process of collective exploration and, I guess, the forming of a group dynamic in the process of making a dance production. And working in dance, you know, we cross a lot of physical boundaries that wouldn't be crossed in normal interactions with people. We're very used to piling on top of each other and rolling around. You know, contact improvisation and contact work in general is a big part of what we do. So there are deep connections that I think are made very quickly in that process. And in terms of my relationship to the dancers and developing their confidence, of course, it varies from dancer to dancer. But what I like to try and encourage is their sense of connection to each other, is the shifting of their awareness from themselves in an internal focus, which of course can be useful at times, you know, the introspection and the drawing of sensation and knowledge from the interior can be a very powerful tool in dance, but the sensing of other people and the connections between people is something I really enjoy. I think both from my experience of performing myself, I found that connection, that outward connection and perception and responsiveness to others on stage or in the studio was liberating in a way from the internal scrutiny that we can sometimes have of ourselves, and really helped find a deeper connection and sense of synchrony.
Have you learned about yourself and your limits through collaborating with, let's say, Steve Lehman and Tai Shinsori and Wadada Leo Smith, or even with the whole orchestras like the Boston Modern Orchestras? Do surprises still happen?
Yeah, it's always a surprise. It's also always familiar. I think I've gotten used to being surprised. I think that's the best way to put it. You know, I think he was just describing as the discovery of what it is we can do together, and the repeated discovery, like rediscovery of the unlimited possibility of us building together, sensing together and acting together, this unlimited range of possibilities. You know, when I think of all the music I've made with Tai Shinsori over almost 25 years, you know, when I first met him, he was 19 or 20 and already basically fully formed in terms of his towering musical brilliance and profound talent. He was still forming as a person, as we all always are, but he was already so tapped in to some essentials, so that I felt like we could do anything together. And over the years, we have. We've really, every time, it's like this miracle. You know, we've done all kinds of stuff together over the years musically, and we've taught and learned together. He's about 9 years younger than me, but it's kind of like a familial connection. It's like brothers, you know.
And are you always a good listener?
I try to be. I've learned a lot about how to be by these artists you mentioned, particularly Tyshawn and Wadada especially. Well, one thing I learned very early on is that Tyshawn and Wadada, they both hear everything I do. And so I always know that, you know, they hear and understand it. Meaning, like, Tyshawn produces an instant kind of, to call it analysis is to put it sort of in very cold terms. It's really like he receives it and is one with it.
Isn't it also like an act of humbleness?
Yeah, there's humility in it, and there's support is what it is. Like, he supports what I do so that I feel like I can do anything and it will be made to make sense. You know, he will make sense of it. He will support it. He will extend it, and he will build with it. And that's really how we function together. It's like there's this constant axis there. With Wadada, I mean, he's 30 years older than me. He hears everything I say. You know, that's what, like, he's really attuned at this level of deep, not just humility, but compassion. So the way he listens is so complete that we can always move in lockstep like that. And it's not that we move by playing the same things, but that we move with this sense of
companionship.
Yeah, like it's kind of like we are forging a path together musically. That's how it feels.
And Alex Whitley was also talking about improvisation, which I think is an essential element happening in this shared space of creativity. How do you define improvisation?
You know, I've spent 30 years thinking about what words to use, and finally I decided to stop. It's not that I want to annihilate this word, but I think that what it does, the way it gets used, is to turn something extremely essential and common to all of us, the moment we're born, into something removed and kind of rarefied and treated as extraordinary. but all we do is improvise. So, which is to say that what is this word referring to? Everything except that which isn't improvised. And so then it's like, well, what isn't improvised? And then we think of things that are written down because they are fixed. But that is such a small part of what we do. You know, it's what we call the archive or something. And so what if we just say that improvisation is everything that escapes the archive?
Yes. Well, let's listen to Alexander Whitley again, this time talking about his first unforeseen encounter with improvisation and the tools he later developed to navigate moments where improvisation is needed.
I have a really vivid memory of the first times I was asked to improvise it, and it was in an audition for a new production. There was a choreographer who'd come into Rombert, the company I was working with at the time, and she wanted to get to know each of the dancers in the company and asked us to improvise. And I just come out of a ballet company and I didn't know what to do because my expression of myself was to do ballet. And I didn't have anything else to draw upon really to say any more about what I could do through dance at that time. And it was so exposing and revealing. And I was also looking around me at the dancers in the company at the time who did have this amazing sense of or ability to move freely and to explore. That was incredibly inspiring to see what was possible and to have a peer group around me that I could learn from and observe and develop my practice alongside. But I guess I grew to realize that improvisation isn't just about doing anything that comes to mind. There's a technique to it. There are frameworks for improvising around. And as I started to build up a toolkit of ideas and strategies for approaching improvisation, that started to unlock something. Having these tools at your disposal and relatively simple or straightforward ideas that you can deploy quickly in a range of different ways can unlock endless possibilities. And I think that ability to be thinking in movement, to be making complex or sophisticated choices as you're moving in action, being present and in the moment and responding to things within your environment. It could be objects, there could be other people, they could be sounds, you know, all of these different sensory elements that we can refer to and draw upon, as well as, you know, internal sensations, concepts, abstract ideas. And yeah, it's a rich world that opens up when those techniques or strategies crystallize.
The same happens in music. And I know, Mr. Iyer, you don't like frameworks. But are there any, are there any tools you can call upon for improvisation?
Yeah, I mean, it is true that every, you know, when he said moving freely and exploring, what child does not do that, you know? And then exploring what? Well, exploring the environment, exploring the self, exploring each other. This is what we all do. To refine that in the same way that we learn words and then learn other words and then find other ways to say things and refine our thinking about something or refine our vocabulary. This is something we do also naturally. So I know what he's referring to when he says, well, I only had this or that language that I had been taught. And what that means, he's talking about ballet, but certainly classical musicians have the same experience. And I have this kind of, I guess, I have multiple personalities musically because I grew up taking violin lessons. For 15 years, I had Western classical violin lessons.
And you're a composer of classical music, too.
Eventually. I had to come around to that much later. But what I also did while I was taking lessons on violin was playing piano by ear, completely on my own, unguided, untutored, and just figuring things out. So I was this wild kid on the piano, like a feral child. And then I was this very governed and, you know, tamed person on the violin, to the point where then, and even today, if you asked me to improvise on violin, I would not know how, which is to say I was taught how to not improvise. And so if we think of classical anything as methods of teaching you how to not
jump out of the framework.
Yeah, how to not do something and how to only do something else, you know.
Keep drawing inside the lines.
Well, right, yeah. I mean, it's so I know this feeling, but I also know the opposite feeling, which is to, in fact, be so unmoored. I'm not sure what to do, but the first step I take gives me some sense of what could happen. And then I take another step, and then suddenly I'm building form. The methods he's talking about, which are sort of relational in the sense of like, well, what if you have a technique of relating to somebody else in a very specific way, like mirroring them, for example, or producing some kind of counterpoint to what they're doing, or translating what their arm does onto what your leg does, you know, things like this. These are relational strategies, you could say, which we do all the time in music, which is like, well, synchronize with this person, build something together that has the same rhythmic impulse in it, or move around in this formal structure freely. You could think of it as like setting some ground rules or something, or some parameters, which still produces unforeseen outcomes.
Or you find yourself always ready to what improvisation asks of you, meaning to let it transform and truly connect you to the moment.
I'm careful with this kind of language because it creates a certain exceptionalism and has a way of sort of reifying this idea that is so ordinary, whether it's improvisation or present or moment. You know, like, this is always at hand, all of this. I'm doing it right now by talking to you. Every conversation is this way, I hope, if you're not like just pressing buttons and saying something routine that you've already organized in your head.
Or repeat, because that can also...
Talking points,
right? Yeah, that would be, that's also very common, you know, from people arguing politics or whatever, it's repetition of certain arguments.
Sure.
Always, that happens a lot.
Yeah, no, and we're all familiar with that, but we also try not to live that way. I don't know, I think we... lapse into certain kinds of routines, but also to demand originality from every moment is not appropriate. If I use a word today that I used yesterday, that's okay. I am here today with that same word, and it feels different to me today than yesterday. Or maybe it feels the same, but I don't even have any way of knowing, actually, because the feeling of yesterday is no longer here. It's just a memory, and that memory might be distorted, you know, so all we have is the present, and that's not a magical statement. It's just a fact.
But it happens that people are not present in the present, or that we're not present in the present. That happens. Let's listen to Harvard professor Rudolf Tanzi, one of the leading voices in the fight against Alzheimer's, and also a musician. I would like to share what he says about the part of the brain that controls personality versus the more timeless, spaceless part of the brain, and what it means for our mental health when we are operating from one versus the other.
The circuitry in the brain where we live every day that creates who we are personality-wise, that allows us to make judgments but observations, that allows us to contextualize the world in a specific way that matches our personality, is called the default mode network. And interestingly, Alzheimer's pathology travels specifically through the default mode network circuitry of the brain. And when you use the default mode network, which is when you're not creative, you're not being creative, you're not improvising, you're not focusing on a task, whether it be a sport or a hobby or music, the default mode network is where amyloid forms with neural activity, most earliest in the disease. How do you turn it off? Focus on a hobby, a task, could be gardening, a sport. Anytime you're mindful, you're engaged, you're not just perseverating or thinking about the future, maybe with anxiety, or thinking about the past, maybe with some obsessiveness, you're not judging yourself or others, the default mode network is turned off. So for a musician, turning that default mode network off and going into that timeless, spaceless part of the brain where you can create, you play from intuition. You don't play from cliche or preconceived notions. That for me is like, that is medicine. Anytime you can do anything that's creative and mindful, where you're escaping the default mode network, you can breathe more easily and you basically turn off the parts of the brain where Alzheimer's disease spreads. And that's what hobbies and creativity do for you. And music is a wonderful way to do it, where you're in the moment and you're focusing and you're free of everything that would otherwise control your personality.
And you were mentioning Wadada, Leo Smith, who can help you create a safe, playful space. And we're hearing now him in the background, an amazing trumpeter. You both seem to find each other in perfect timing whenever you play together. Your collaboration with him, I think, are so cosmic. I chose somewhat of the album called Defiant Life, which has been accurately described as deeply meditative and spiritually intense. Tell us a little bit more about this incredible musical relationship you have with him. You've already said that he's compassionate, that he's humble. Can you tell us a bit more about being with him in stage?
Every moment I've shared with him has had this resonant glow. What it means to say that somebody is spiritual, I don't know. I mean, I've heard that word probably my whole life, and I didn't really grasp what it was supposed to be about. But then I remember one time I heard him say to somebody else that spirituality is about your relationship to the highest powers in the universe. And he said this without a moment's hesitation, you know?
With certainty.
Yes, and so that's part of it, is that he's reflected on those questions for a long time.
Or experience it.
Yeah, it guides him, you know, and it helps him make the choices he makes as an artist, as a, just as a human being, among others, you know, in terms of his sense of interconnectedness with other people, his sense of ethical clarity, his vision for what art can do, and his way of building, tapping into intuition, working with great discipline. I think it's that combination of things that puts him in contact with some essentials and some eternal truths that then, being around it, you feel like it's touching you as well. I said the other day that we were interviewed after our concert, I said that he's been like a guru to me in the most ancient sense of that word, which is to say that he, you know, I didn't know this in the beginning. Well, I first met him in my 20s, in the 90s, and then I started working with him in 2005 regularly. Little by little, I kept noticing that something he said, or something he did, or something he played, or a piece of music he made had changed me, you know, had transformed me in a way that I wasn't the same person anymore. And I would walk around with a phrase he had uttered, just sort of alive in my ear still, you know, for weeks or for years. Yeah, I don't even know how else to describe it.
What a privilege.
Yeah.
What a privilege.
It's true.
And do you both leave open spaces that can be filled intuitively? You, meaning both you two, because I'm pretty sure
that's all we do.
Yeah.
This is the thing, is that it was he who initiated the phrase creative music as a way to describe what he and what all of us do. And this is like from the 60s, he offered this phrase, partly in the sense of like claiming control over the language we use to describe what we do. But also it's a very descriptive phrase, in the sense that what it means is that the creative process is involved in the moment of performance, which is to say that we can talk about creative musicians. The way he defines it is that if a creative musician is someone such that if you replace them in the music, then it's the music is different, which means that that person's creative input appears in the moment of music making. And that is just a very essential truth about what we do, which means that even when we have material that has a score, which we do quite often, that it doesn't manifest the same way each time. So the score has an aliveness to it.
Fantastic.
Hi, we would love to hear your comments and learn about what you see. Share your input at www.ccpodcast.com and follow us on social media. Oh, I almost forgot. To accompany us in this season's journey, don't forget to hit the subscribe button. And now let's continue with CC.
Talking about intuition and the feeling of knowing what is coming next. Fellow guest, neurosurgeon whose profound near-death experience challenged his scientific understanding of consciousness, and whose work is now dedicated to neuroscience and spirituality, left a compelling question for you.
Hello, I'm Dr. Evan Alexander. Do you have an explanation for the observation that one can hear the beginning of a musical piece they might not have heard for years and have high-quality memory of what follows? How are music and memory so effectively intertwined compared to other forms of memory?
Yes, I don't have any neurological insight into that. I do know that we can play music back to ourselves in our minds. We don't need headphones for that, you know. We can sing to ourselves silently. I think whenever we do that, we're playing back some representation of it, which is to say, it can be alive to us, but it is also our creation, something that we have produced inside of ourselves. It's not merely a reflection. We are not recording devices, right? We are what we are and who we are. We are human beings, which means that what lodges itself in our memory is something that is itself a creation of our own. That means that we can revisit it and recreate it. You know, there is a kind of detail there that we're capable of that's still a bit of a mystery, I think, in the sense that why is it that musical memory works so well? We could instead ask, why don't other forms of memory work as well? And then even when we think we remember something, we're forgetting something about it. And so every memory is also an act of forgetting.
Yes, and remembering selectively, I think, too.
Yeah.
You know, coming back to music as a shared bodily experience, at the beginning we were talking about how listening is key. And the listening needs to be active in order for music to emerge from the different exchanges happening between and among emissary and receptor. Wadada, Leo Smith being one of an excellent listeners, right? Well, I always thought of this in regards of writers and readers or painters and those who recognize something in the painter's painting, resulting in a dialogue that is never passive. And this makes me think about the fact that art is truly a happening, something alive. So in music, how do you think this happening relates to memories, this dialogue of listener and emissary receptor going back and forth, back and forth? And what role does memory play in these exchanges?
Well, there's a kind of recognition that happens. And certainly when we recognize something, we think we understand it. I think the belief that music is something that is understood is a bit of a myth. It needs to be dispelled or at least complicated. But sometimes recognition assures us that we are not at risk or we are not in unknown territory. So then we feel like we're in a safe place that won't demand too much of us, that won't ask too many questions. And that functions in certain ways to govern the way one listens, in the sense that it can, in fact, relieve you of some sense of obligation to be present, because you just feel like, oh, well, I know this song. In fact, I can sing along. And sometimes that can produce a certain feeling of joy that is just simply joy in the familiar.
Do you think the listener is transported back in time when a song is played again, again and again? Do you think the listener is transported back in time, or do you think that each time someone listens to the same song, they add a new experience to it.
You know, my friend Nina Sun Eidsheim has written about this in her book Sensing Sound. She wanted to account for the fact that the same song can make you or break you, depending on the day. Or, you know, and we think that because it's just a digital file, let's say, we think that it's the same song, but the body has changed, which means that it lands differently. You're in a different moment in your arc of life.
So we keep adding layers and layers, like in language?
Adding and also subtracting, in the sense that we don't remember everything that ever happened to us at all times, right? Certain things escape our attention, others kind of overwhelm our attention. I'm thinking of the musical world that I've been a part of. We're constantly remaking some of the same material. Like if you play a standard or something, like a song that's been played thousands of times before, but you somehow make it your version today. Or I remember hearing Prince in the 90s, that time I mentioned, and he did that song, If I Was Your Girlfriend. But he didn't sing it in that falsetto that we know from the recording. In fact, he sang it down here in a baritone voice. And it sounded so different. I was overwhelmed. I couldn't believe that, yes, this is the same song, and yet it is not at all the same song. It means something completely different. It feels different. It lands different. It hits different. And so that was, in a way, just simply affirming this fact that any piece of music remains alive to you on each encounter, meaning that it is not the same because you are not the same.
In the happening of making and listening to music, you must learn to navigate different cultural conceptions of rhythm and time, I suppose. In what ways do you think our listening capacities are shaped by culture or our own interpretations and our own memories? And how do these factors influence or limit our ability to understand and interpret the music that we hear?
I'm reminded of this philosopher I once met in India named G.S. Money. And he said, "You are nothing but memories, sir." That doesn't mean that we can't make new ones or that we can't find ourselves somehow reborn through new experience, but that so much of how we experience anything is governed by what we remember about past experiences. And that's meaning that's what learning is. And so I see it happen all the time that what people learn shapes the way they listen. For example, if somebody hears everything in terms of tonal harmony, because they've learned it, they've studied it, they've learned about harmonic progressions that get used in Western classical music and then in, say, like American song forms, then if they hear something that isn't that, the only word they have for it is out, like outside, meaning not inside of my understanding of what music can do. Mm-hmm. So then they hear things in a narrow way. And I've seen it happen where musicians who think they know what's happening will try to transcribe something and they write it down wrong because they are resolving it onto the language they know. I see that happen all the time with students and with professional musicians, even people, my colleagues. I see that happen all the time.
Oh my God.
Not the ones I mentioned.
Yeah, don't give me names.
I won't name any names. But it's really because try to decode is to try to make sense of something in terms of the sense that you
already know.
Yeah, what makes sense to you. And so something that challenges your sense of what makes sense will often elude you. It will elude your perception even. So, you know, it's kind of the challenge, which then becomes like a value system or a kind of judgment about what's quote unquote good or what's right, you know, and
what's good music, what's bad music.
And what I find is that musicians are often so caught up in their own ways of listening in this analytical way that they're not hearing everything. And what I find is that non-musicians have so much more to teach me about what music does and how it works and what's in it and how makes sense to anybody, or how it means anything to anybody, how it matters.
I know what you mean. The way our cultural differences are often used as a barrier, and at the same time, how, if we open ourselves, music can be used to connect people from different backgrounds. And this reminded me of a very good anecdote that has stayed with me forever. Colombia in the 1980s was in a very tense moment of its history because people were living through bombings and kidnappings and constant threats, especially from the Medellin cartel, which terrorized people. And the French embassy in Bogota, like many others, was surrounded by armed soldiers for protection. And yet, inside all that tension, something almost magical would happen. The embassy cook, a woman who adored cumbia, of course, would turn on her radio while cooking, leaving the rhythms to spill into the courtyards. And every now and then, the ambassador or his wife would glance outside and spot the soldiers. And these were supposed to stand, you know, perfectly still with their rifles, but they just couldn't help it. They would start moving their shoulders slightly back and forth, making tiny steps, 1, 2, and 3, 4, to the beat of the cumbia, without losing their position, of course, so that no one could notice. But they noticed. And for the Europeans inside the embassy, this felt surreal. Just imagine, in the middle of bomb threats and tensions, this small moment of joy, of people being human, would later be recalled and described by them as liberating, as if cumbia was sneaking past the armor, reminding everyone that life was still pulsing underneath all that fear. And you say that listening to music requires empathy, respect, and a willingness to be transformed by the perspective of others, if I understand well.
I said that.
And I think this is exactly how it was for the diplomats in that embassy. I believe that cumbia uncovered layers of perception that would otherwise have been disguised as pure entertainment. Cumbia meant survival for the cook and soldiers. And the diplomats had a glance into this world, and this was a transformative experience for them. So listening to different kinds of music demands openness and willingness to discover. And out from extreme conditions like the one I just described, in which we do not want to become only educated listeners, but active listeners able to enjoy that diversity, how can we open ourselves increasingly to the experience of music?
Thank you for the story. You know, music is already in everybody's lives. So I am not here to prescribe some better way for somebody to live. And I even wouldn't say that listening to music requires empathy, because you can't require anything of anybody, you know. I'd say that it asks for it, you know.
And we have to be willing to say yes.
But it's also possible to listen without it, which is how, in fact, the way that music sort of wallpapers our daily life, you know, when you go to a grocery store or department or like clothing store or a restaurant or something, and it's just on, and you can kind of pretend that no humans were involved in this, you know, you can just let it be this, I don't know, just this stream of sensation that kind of carries you through the day, you know, or supports some other, you can easily forget that it was made by people. And in fact, we're almost forced to imagine this all the time. So to bring music back into that, you know, what if you listen to music as human action? Then what does that ask of you? If you start from that premise, then maybe you start to ask questions like, well, who were they? Where were they? When did they do this? Why? You know, how many of them? Were they men or women or both? What were they wearing? Where are they from? How did they find each other? How did this happen? You know, like all of these simple questions that then you start to maybe care about somebody who might be involved in it. And this is this funny thing about recordings, is that it dangles that set of questions in front of you, but it also can allow you to forget to ask them.
And talking about being confronted with something that feels foreign, that pulls us out of our cultural comfort zone. Well, in an interview with German theologist Professor Bruno Schlegelberger, who specializes in various areas of study, including interfaith and indigenous peoples' cultures in religions in Latin America, explained how encounters with foreign cultures, usually a person from another culture, country, race, or religion, meaning the contact with the, in quotes, the different, helps us to understand our own culture and the deepest meaning of our own existence. And he exemplified this with the story of Rabbi Isaac, a resumed version of which we are about to hear, followed by the interpretation of Rabbi Rami Shapir of the same story, and the message of another story about the Sufi saint Nasreddin.
After many years of great poverty, which had never shaken his faith in God, Rabbi Isaac dreamed someone bade him look for a treasure in Prague under the bridge which leads to the king's palace. When the dream recurred a third time, he prepared for the journey and set out for Prague. But the bridge was guarded day and night, and he did not dare to start digging. Nevertheless, he went to the bridge every morning and kept walking around it until evening. Finally, the captain of the guards who had been watching him asked in a kindly way whether he was looking for something or waiting for somebody. Rabbi Isaac told him of the dream which had brought him here from a faraway country. The captain laughed. "Ah, and so to please the dream, you poor fellow wore out your shoes to come here. As for having faith in dreams, if I had had it, I should have had to get going when a dream once told me to go to Krakow and dig for treasure under the stove in the room of a Jew. Isaac, son of Yekel, that was the name. Isaac, son of Yekel. I can just imagine what it would be like. How I should have to try every house over there, where one half of the Jews are named Isaac, and the other half Yekel." And he laughed again. Rabbi Isaac bowed, travelled home, dug up the treasure from under the stove, and built the house of prayer, which is called Reb Isaac's Shul.
You know, the treasure that the rabbi had was under his own bed. You know, he went searching for it elsewhere, but ultimately it's in his own home. There's a story from the Sufi tradition of Islam about the Sufi saint Nasreddin. And Nasreddin is this great mullah, this great saint. And there's a story about him that when he lost the keys to his house, and he's outside looking under a lamppost and he's digging in the ground, and people come by and they say, "Mullah Nasreddin, what are you doing?" And he says, "I lost the keys to my house." And they say, "Oh, let's help you find them." And they're getting on the ground. They're all digging under the lamppost, and people come by and they ask what they're doing, and they tell them, "We're looking for Nasreddin's keys." And it just gets to be more and more people, and they can't find them. And finally, someone says, "Well, you know, where do you think you dropped them?" And he says, "Oh, I dropped them in my house." And they say, "Well, why are you out here under the lamppost?" And he says, "Well, the light is better out here," right? The keys, whether you call them salvation or enlightenment or wisdom or whatever it is, the keys are always in our house, but usually in the dark place of a dream, the dark place of our unconscious. But humans like to go to the light, right? Our religions are all about going to the light. But the light is not where the answer is. The answer is you go to the dark place, the shadow place, like Jung would say. And oftentimes you can't go there directly. You have to go out and see the other culture, the other language, the other spiritual tradition that helps you then return to your own house.
We're hearing in the background Embracing Difference, a song that is part of the most recent album Thereupon by Fieldwork, a trio where you, Mr. Iyer, play the piano and the Fender Rhodes, Steve Lehman plays the saxophone, and Taishan Sori plays the drums. An excellent avant-garde album and a very challenging one. What is the philosophical dimension of this album that pushes listeners out of their comfort zone into a complex rhythmic interplay?
I'm trying to think of how to answer this in terms of all that you just shared. That composition titled Embracing Difference is by Steve Lehman. And I remember when he brought it in, I'm like, it's a funny title. I said to him, partly because I think what it is to live in the West and be marked by difference is to be always like treated as somehow other. You know, I've experienced this my whole life, being the child of immigrants from India in the United States. And I thought a lot about my father, who passed away in 2021. The India that he knew was not the nation of India that we know today, because he was born in 1933. So his first 14 years were actually living all over the subcontinent, the South Asian subcontinent. His father was stationed in a different place every 6 months. And so he wound up kind of living everywhere, including what's now Pakistan and even close to what's now Afghanistan and all over North and South India. So he had to embrace difference on a daily basis. There was the different languages that he spoke at home, English and Tamil, and then there were the languages he encountered from his schoolmates and these new schools that he kept getting put into where he could barely keep up. And I guess the other thing is that kind of coexistence was quite normal before the nation was divided by external forces into these categories, which is to say that people lived alongside each other with different faiths and different even ethnic backgrounds from around the subcontinent. As a matter of course, it was just like something that had been happening for centuries, you know. The concept of nation, which is actually relatively new in human history, it's only a few hundred years old, because we think of those as fixed identities rather than as constructed ones. And we're born into them, so we are indoctrinated into this way of thinking. We think of difference as something that needs to be conquered rather than something that's just a normal part of heterogeneous human life. Certainly in the cities of past empires like Rome, you'd find all kinds of people thrown together, right? From across the entire span of empire. So that doesn't mean that they were living in some kind of benign, happy coexistence, but that it was just ordinary to see each other on a daily basis and learn to live together, maybe contentiously, maybe peacefully. I suppose living as I have for 27 or 28 years in New York City, and I live in Harlem, in fact, which is a historically black neighborhood and has been for at least a century, I am just accustomed to the people around me being of different backgrounds, different faiths, different histories, different ethnicities, different languages being spoken on the street around me. You know, if you look at Queens, New York, which is part of New York City, it is known as the most diverse place on earth. And that's just sort of ordinary. Difference has been kind of reified in the West as something to address and something to figure out rather than something to embrace.
Exactly. But that demands, though, because of all of these fixed ideas, as you say, going also into that own dark place, as Rabbi Rami mentioned, to be able to break the barriers and between each other.
Yeah. I mean, your question was about music, and I barely spoke about it.
Oh, no, don't worry. No, because that encounter, you know, then you're talking about of what was, it's strange at the beginning, and then it becomes an everyday reality that it's found later in ourself. As Professor Schlegelberger mentioned, is, I think, the treasure we find in diversity. How you grow inside. And it is a reflection of existence, if you think about it. Mm-hmm. What is the treasure, do you think, it offered this album, Embracing Difference? What is the treasure that it offered for the band and for the audience?
that particular piece, playing it back in my head right now. It has different kind of, let's say, episodes within it, where different members of the group are foregrounded and different rhythmic forms are kind of supporting these ways of moving together. I think actually what it shares is like this profound unity. You know, that axis I was talking about between Tyshawn and me? I hear it in there, and I hear like that we're able to somehow, all three of us, Steve Lehman and I and Tyshawn, despite the fact that we're all clearly doing very different things, that there are these orienting forces that unify us. I think that's part of it. You know, if you think about chamber music, what's called chamber music, which is typically where everyone's playing something different. And you could describe this piece as chamber music in that way. And yet there's a unity that's formed from these disparate elements that, you know,
it's like the newborn.
Right. So it kind of becomes this composite unity where there are these unlikely or uncanny synchronies happening. And again, if you remind yourself that these are human beings doing this, it's not just some tumult of sound, but it's actually the record of a set of actions. And that then what this means is that somehow we did all that together.
Your article, Embodied Mind, Situated Cognition, and Expressive Microtiming in African-American Music, talks about rhythmic nuance as a product of community practice as being intrinsically bound with dance. Could you explain why people raised in different traditions feel rhythm different? Like rhythm, what I thought that would be so intuitively. And what role does dance play in these nuances?
You're taking me back to something that was published in 2002, but okay. Again, I don't want to essentialize difference, but only to say that it has something to do with how you're taught to move. And we often don't think we're being taught to move, but we are. We're being taught to move or to not move. We're being taught to sit up straight. How many times has somebody said that to you?
Oh, well, I said that every time to my kids.
That's right.
On the table.
Which means probably that at some point when you were a kid, somebody said it to you, right? So there's a kind of governance. Foucault called governmentality, right? Which is that not the fact of being governed, but the way that we take on systems of government internally, that we basically govern ourselves. Mm-hmm. We are taught to govern ourselves in a certain way. Even like a caretaker of children in the old days was called a governess. Right. So this way of...
tame us.
Yes, exactly. That's right. And teach us to tame ourselves. Anyway, it's just how culture lives on in our bodies, whether or not we notice that it's happening.
Which sometimes can be good, because these are also references that you can later break.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But yeah. But they're references that help us navigate, in a sense.
And
too.
Which is to say it's not essential. It's
if you
not,
once have one of my kids at your table, I don't want them just to be, you know, I want them to stand properly.
Yeah, but which is to say also that we can learn the methods of another. We're not stuck in these things. So, which is to say it's not essential or racial or something like that. It's not something that is in our blood. Mm-hmm. It's something that is in our bodies because our bodies were taught, which means that we can keep learning. We can learn something new about how to move.
So but there's hope for a lot of people that doesn't know how to dance or think they cannot dance.
Because I had that double life growing up musically. I remember when I first started playing in an orchestra when I was in fifth grade or something, I was told not to tap my foot and not to move my body so much. We're playing violin in an orchestra, so sure. You know, that's where there's this kind of governance of, of human movement in the way that, you know, an individual in the aggregate drawing attention to themselves by moving out of sync with everybody or moving in a way that's overly expressive can distract and can undermine the larger purpose, let's say, or mission. But then, like, that mentality of like suppressing what music is doing to you, you know?
The next time I go to the Philharmonic, I'm just going to spot the rebels. the ones tapping with the...
Oh, they probably didn't get hired in the first place.
Well, there's some out there.
Yeah, sure. You know, then I had to learn, actually, when I started, not just quote-unquote playing jazz, whatever that means, but actually playing with people who were deep in this other musical world, particularly of Black music and Black musicians, working with elder Black musicians. When I was in my late teens, early 20s, I realized that there were certain things I hadn't learned. Even though I had tried to learn by listening to the records and studying the music carefully on my own terms, but learning how to actually support rhythm, like to actually focus on that, to focus on groove as the sort of like central element, this sort of what you could call a metronomic sense of pulse that then supports dance. That dance impulse in the music, I had to sort of tune into it again and find my own orientation to pulse. And that was something I had to kind of train. I had to train by doing it. You know, I had to learn by being in context and learn how to play in a rhythm section.
Talking about rhythm and timing, we will hear from the four-time Grammy-winning iconic drummer, Terry Lynn Carrington.
That's great.
Who will discuss how jazz enables the stretching of time and the changing of rhythms.
Jazz was originally manifested as freedom music. This was a way to let your creativity take you to as far as it can go. The idea is to be free within a given set of boundaries. And then the idea is to keep stretching those boundaries. So if you have a piece of music that, you know, says this is what it is, you find ways to really be free within that. So that's like, for instance, somebody playing over a jazz standard and they're improvising within that context of that piece. And then you start figuring out how to stretch those boundaries. You start reharmonizing. You start changing the rhythms. If it's in four, maybe you put it in five or seven. You start, you know, doing things like being a rubato, so you're not strict with time. And then you start creating new forms. And that's the big thing that jazz has done. It has kept innovating form.
At what point do the pushes and pulls that Terry Lynn was talking about remain recreational within the creative process? And at what point do they become risks that allow for innovation and breakthrough? Or it just happens?
Well, I think of how much has changed in this area of music, even in the last 30 years that I've been involved in it. All those things that she talks about have become now commonplace. Whereas back then when I first got into it, more than 30 years, let's say 40 years, in fact, it was not so common to stretch in specific way, in some of the ways she described. The thing is, there are always elements that, because it's creative music, because the creative process is involved in the moment of performance, like I said, that perhaps when given something like a boundary or a rule, or a shape to obey, the first creative impulse is to resist it or to find a way to reinvent it or to transform it. So that's been happening all along, you know. I mean, I think back to Billie Holiday singing songs that people thought they knew, like Love for Sale or Don't Explain, or these different, like Terry mentioned, these standards, these songs that people knew from Broadway shows.
Yeah.
And then she would really change it so that it wasn't the same melody. And she'd find a way, as the harmonic progression unfolded, she'd find a way to just make her own melody with the same lyrics. And then I heard Betty Carter doing that much later, you know, in the 80s and 90s, to the point where she would bend the song to within an inch of unrecognizability. You know, like it would be like, is this the same song even? You know, she'd stretch out a phrase across this expanse of time. It was just hers now. It's not about obeying what the composer wrote down. It's actually about using that as almost this open text that can be made new in a way that you will never hear it again and you've never heard it before. That kind of freedom is what she's talking about, which is, it comes from deep knowledge, you know, deep wisdom, sophisticated understanding of what's possible. There's a sort of what I'd call a strain of resistance in it, this refusal to merely accept things as they are.
And you know, you mentioning these songs that people thought what they meant. Well, that happened for me with jazz, because I've listened to it pretty much since I was in my mom's womb. She's a painter and a big jazz lover. So it was always been around. But it wasn't until I spoke with Barbara Holmes, a scholar of African American spirituality and culture, that jazz deeper meaning was revealed. The fact that improvisation in jazz and blues is really a nonverbal form of resistance against oppression. Let's hear from Terry Lynn Carrington again on what she says about jazz and the quest for freedom in life.
The anger of, you know, the resistance against oppression. And so all of these things come up, especially on the drums, you know, where we are playing against all of these oppressive forces that have tried to constrict our intellect, because being creative and being an improviser is intellectual. So you've had, I don't know, hundreds of years of people trying to make sure that you cannot develop your intellect or your creativity, which, you know, are connected. So jazz was a means to keep pushing that boundary that kept being set, doing it in a way that people didn't realize that's what you were doing, because they didn't respect the intellectualism in this art form or the intellectualism in improvisation in general, because it was actually above their heads. You know, the oppressor was not thinking that the blues was deep or that jazz evolved, that any of this was on the high intellectual level that it was. So it became its own language, a nonverbal language that spoke to not just the group of people that were innovating it, but it obviously spoke to many, many more people and many more cultures, and became such an international phenomenon because of it. I believe that it's a quest for freedom, that, you know, our lives in general, the whole trajectory of our lives is a quest for freedom. So musicians have, you know, this gift of making audible the freedom dreams of an entire group of people.
As a musician and a performer, do you regard yourself as a rebel that bends rules in the quest for freedom? Or do you see yourself more as someone who campaigns for freedom and independence by testing the limits of time and rhythm in any kind of structure? Or both?
Yeah, I was going to say, are those different or distinct or opposed to each other?
Slightly.
Slightly opposed, you think?
No, not opposed. I think the first option is a little bit unaware. You know, it just goes breaking. And the other one takes its time, pushes here, pushes there.
What does awareness sound like? Do we actually know? Which is why I asked, what is the difference? We might think we know, but we might be surprised or be...
Well, you said Wadada is able to build a bridge, always in compassion and tended to you when you're making music. And he's listener. He's aware. He's
I know this because of all that I've experienced with him. Somebody on their first encounter know this. I don't know. I think that strain of resistance that I mentioned earlier, that Terry then elaborated on it with, you know, to great effect, that is something that comes in a way partly from a certain circumstance being imposed on an entire population of human beings, which is not only, well, it's basically a certain facet of oppression, let's say, that basically refuses to hear you as a full-fledged human being, meaning somebody with thoughts and feelings. So to listen with compassion is to instead hear someone as a full-fledged human being with thoughts and feelings. But it doesn't always happen, you know? The reason I am careful about using the word jazz, and I almost never use it, is because when people hear it, they think they know what it is. They think that, oh, that's that style. And it isn't a style. You know, as my colleague, Professor Carrington, just said, it's a practice of freedom, which is to say it doesn't have one sound. It is, in fact, it is a, you know, if you listen to this century of music recorded, that goes under this name of jazz. You hear all kinds of manifestations, all kinds of aesthetics, all kinds of ideas, all kinds of human feelings, all kinds of action, all kinds of unity, all kinds of disparateness, all kinds of beauty, all kinds of chaos. Every single possible
outcome.
Yeah. And this is what I mean. It's not a style. You could say there's a history of ideas that's being developed here, you know, and that you'd be right. And this is how I think of it. And I try to, if I ever am teaching that, that's what I teach, is that, well, this person or this group of people had these ideas, and here's where they are. We can hear them. And then this person or this group of people who came not long after them built on those ideas and had ideas of their own that in relation to that or in opposition to that or something, you know, that there's a, you could think of it as an intellectual history in the same way we do with philosophy, for example, or with like literary analysis or something. But to do that, you have to really believe that these are full-fledged human beings with thoughts and feelings, and not everybody does. Especially when you use the word jazz, then people start to think that it can be reduced or be encapsulated in some simplistic, unflattering way.
Yeah. The oldest known musical instrument is a 40,000-year-old bone flute found in Geisenklösterle cave in southern Germany. What do you think inspired humans in the Ice Age to make music? And what does the act of making music mean to you?
You know, I think a lot about an older cave where older human artifacts were found, which is in coastal South Africa. Blombos Cave is called, where human artifacts for making art and for cooking and eating shellfish and sharing communal space date back 100,000 years. 100,000 years. And in fact, the oldest human artwork was found there. It's a block of ochre with a crosshatch pattern on it made by a human hand. And that's from at least 80,000 years ago. And when I think about what was that world like in that cave, what did it sound like? And what do we call that sound? Where was music? How could it have not been there? What would it mean to say that those people didn't have music? What would we be claiming about those people that we will never meet or know anything about except this, that they gathered in a cave and made things together? Did they sing? How could they not? Did they share sound as they shared food? How could they not?
When we ask, why did people make music together? What if we ask instead, how could they not?
And what if we ask also instead, where does that boundary between not yet music and yes, music, where does that begin? Does it begin with a mother singing to her child before that child is born? Does it begin with people just banging on rocks together to make something and maybe finding a synchronous rhythm that helped them do it? Does it begin with people just walking together and synchronizing their steps? All of this belongs in the category that we call music.
Beautiful. This is beautiful. And we come to the last question. And you know, there's this song of Celia Cruz called Life is a Carnival, written by Victor Daniel, released in 1998 on her album Mi Vida es Cantar. She uses to sing this song even having a brain tumor, going out performing and singing, oh, don't cry, life is a carnival, and it's more beautiful to leave you singing, and sorrows go away singing. In essence, I think that she's saying, even though life can be hard, it's meant to be lived with joy, laughter, music, like a carnival, in community, in connection with others. Crossing from one culture to another, as we've been talking about, takes a bit of vulnerability. through art and creativity, we start to find these deep connections that can really help us heal what you were saying, starting to step together, making music, singing to our children when they're in the womb. We often talk about the differences in our music, and yet it's amazing how music breaks down borders and brings us together. So how do you think music helps us tap into those deeper emotions, empathy, love, and compassion across cultures?
How could it not?
This is beautiful. Fantastic way to end up our interview. Thank you, Professor Iyer, for your generosity, for the way you give yourself so completely to music and for the music. Your music brings people closer. It softens the edges in between and lets people feel part of something larger. So please keep on building bridges of compassion and empathy through music. And thank you for such a wonderful interview.
Thank you for putting in all this time to put this together and really paying such careful and loving attention to all that you do.
Thank you to our listeners, wherever you are, for having allowed us to share time with you. You can find Vijay Iyer's music in the platform of your choice. And if you are interested in his next concert, his writings, and future projects, check out his website at vijay-iyer.com. or follow him on social media. For information on the music featured in this episode, including authorship credits and other important links, please check this episode's description. Thank you, and we will see you next time. Bye-bye.